Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Well, she's a cat's meow.
She's a cat's meow.
And a dog's bow wow.
Dog bow wow.
Well, she's everything that a country boy would need. Well, look here, boy, she's staring back at me.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs?
Yeah!
Little Rock's premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, have released 3 full-length studio albums, and their music has been featured on TLC's hit show Trading Spaces and on the award-winning Sundance Channel hit show Rectify. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Argenta branch of William F. Lehman Public Library in beautiful downtown North Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and tonight's food is provided by the incredible Trio's Restaurant in Little Rock. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with the late Willie James Foster of Muddy Waters fame, among many, many others. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? From rural Arkansas, award-winning novelist Dr. Daniel Black graduated from Clark College magna cum laude and was then awarded a full fellowship to Temple University, where he studied with the poet laureate of the Black Arts Movement, Professor Sonia Sanchez. His works include They Tell Me of a Home, The Sacred Place, Perfect Peace, 12 Gates to the City, and The Coming. Dr. Black has been nominated for the Townsend Literary Prize twice, the Ernest J. Gaines Award, the Farrow Grumbly Literary Prize, the Lambda Literary Award, the Georgia Author of the Year Prize, and the Distinguished Writers Award from the Mid-Atlantic Writers Association. For his novel Perfect Peace, in 2011, the GOG National Book Club Committee named him its Author of the Year. This novel has been reprinted more than 10 times and is being heralded as a major American literary classic. Daniel currently lives in Atlanta and is professor of African American Studies at Clark Atlanta University and Morehouse College. Tonight, Daniel takes us back to his childhood and a catch he'll never forget in A Seat in the Boat. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Daniel Black.
I opened my eyes and thought I was still asleep. It was cool now, somewhere in the 50s perhaps, and someone had me bundled in a blanket so tightly I could hardly move. Above my head, tree limbs stretched from one side of the lake cove to the other, and leaning up slightly, I saw wild ferns and other bushes covering the bank like plush carpet. Everything was some shade of green, jade, avocado, emerald, olive, and everything was still. Perfectly still. The morning silence was new to me, as usually I would have been asleep at this hour, but not today. This was the moment I'd begged Daddy for. He parked the boat between 2 tree stumps without saying a word. With thick rope tied to each end of the boat, he wrapped the other end around the stumps to keep the boat from moving. Then he dropped an anchor. Back in the rear of the boat, he began to assemble his rod and reel. Within minutes, he spoke his first words of the day. All right, boy, let's see what you got. I wiggled free of the blanket, still in my pajamas beneath. Someone had forced an old pair of jeans and a large gray hoodie upon me, and although they felt heavy and binding, I was warm, so I didn't complain. By now, the murky, blurry morning sight had vanished and my clear vision had arrived. Daddy passed me a brand new fishing pole, slightly smaller than his, and smiled. I smiled too. I knew now that part of fishing was silence, so I began to hustle about just as Daddy was doing, without saying a word. He taught me the art of casting in the front yard. I was only 4 then. It took me a while to get the hang of it, the press and release action of the 501 Zebco reel, but by 5, I was an old pro. Mama said I had to be 6 to get in a boat. Daddy didn't agree, but he wasn't willing to fight about it. So the morning after my 6th birthday, I found myself upon the water. I didn't know that fish eat breakfast so early. It had to have been dark when we left because the sky lightened as I opened my eyes. Lazy turtles, or tappins, as Daddy called them, lounged on broken limbs jutting up from the water, and mosquito-like things dashed across the surface as if ice skating. Every time I glanced at Daddy, he was looking at me, but he never said a word. I began to assemble my fishing line, tying the hook, threading the lead, placing the bobber. These were all things Dad had taught in preparation for my debut at the lake. We'd sat on the banks of the pond behind the house many a day, moving artificial lures through the water easily until I had the hang of things. I preferred live bait because I believed the fish knew the difference. Dad said they didn't, but I wasn't convinced. So the morning of my first official trip, I looped the 4-pound fishing line 8 times through the head of the hook and nodded. Dad nodded. I was ready. I would recall years later that it must have been March or April that year. Jonquil stood along the top of the banks on both sides, and once the sun rose, the chilly spring air vanished. Dad had a cooler of drinks and snacks, which Mom undoubtedly made him bring, but food meant nothing to me. I didn't even want it. I wanted to catch something big enough to earn my seat in the boat. That's how Dad had put it. He said a man ain't worth his seat in the boat unless he catches something worth taking home. And that's exactly what I meant to do. Hooked the minnow through the back part of the mouth, boy, Daddy said, although he wasn't looking at me. How did he know I had a minnow in my hand? Set your cork about 2 feet above your hook. They run shallow this time of year. I obeyed. When he reeled in and cast, I looked at the distance between his bobber and hook to make sure I knew just how long 2 feet was. I still had not spoken. There was lots of brush in the water, stumps, logs, lily pads, rocks, where crappie loved to hide. That was the only fish Daddy wanted, black speckled crappie, and I aimed to drag out a big one. A few other boats eased by and men nodded once each, so I did the same. Their boats were nicer than ours and much bigger, but none of them had my Daddy in it. I cast close to a stump and waited. Daddy was fishing the back end of the boat, having cast several times without getting a bite. Soon my patience ran thin and I reeled in and cast again in the same direction. This time my line snagged on the roots of the stump. I looked at Daddy. He didn't look at me. I'd have to break it. There was no other choice. I felt Daddy's eyes on the back of my head, but I didn't look around. I simply broke the line and retracted the string and started the assembly process all over again. I had my own tackle box, which I bought with my own birthday money. I had stocked it heavily, so I didn't have to interrupt Dad for anything. I was glad. His annoyance flared whenever he had to stop fishing to deal with someone. Minutes later, I was back in the water. I tossed further away from the stump, though still fairly close to it, and stared at the bobber, waiting for it to disappear. But nothing happened. Suddenly, Daddy grunted, "Come on, boy. Come on, baby." I turned to see his pole bent practically in half. From the looks of things, his bottom lip wouldn't survive the excitement. "Hand me the net, boy," he hollered. I dropped my pole and tossed the end of the aluminum net close enough for him to grab it. He grabbed it with his left hand, then he held the trembling rod, and with his right, he scooped beneath the water and brought up a crappie so big I murmured, "Dang, Dad, wow." He chuckled slightly as if he were the pro, but he said nothing. I resumed watching my bobber. He was one fish ahead of me, but the battle was not over. I continued waiting. My bobber seemed frozen on top of the water. Then it moved slightly. I leaned forward in excitement. "Let him take it good," Daddy said. In a flash, it vanished. I jerked my rod upward and it bent like a bow. Daddy, 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 I got one. Daddy said, you ain't got nothing yet. Take your time, boy, and get him in the boat. My pole was curved harder than daddy's had been, at least I thought it was. The fish meandered throughout the open lake. Get him close to the boat, boy, and I'll scoop up under him. But he was too heavy to maneuver. With each turn of the reel, I feared the line would break and I'd lose my seat in the boat. He's too heavy, daddy, I can't get him. Help me. Daddy didn't move. If you gonna fish, you gonna catch your own. Now get that damn fish in this boat, boy. I didn't really want daddy's help. That's what I told myself once he refused it. But I didn't know crappie could be so heavy either. It felt like a cinder block on the end of my line. Try as I might, I couldn't get the fish close to the boat. Set your drag, son, set your drag. Hurry, before he breaks your line. I did as instructed. Ooh, look like you got a good one there. The excitement in daddy's tone made me even more determined to hold this fish in my hands. Let him get tired. Go easy. Work with him. You got him. I relaxed a bit but kept reeling. Just when I was sure I had him, he pulled away and swam in the opposite direction. If this string breaks, I thought, I'll jump in this water and go after that fish myself. Daddy held the net waiting. Bring him closer in, boy. Come on. Bring him in. I can't, daddy. He's too heavy. Yes, you can. Lift your rod high as you can, then bring it down quickly while you're reeling. I think you snagged him pretty good. He shouldn't get away. Moments later, daddy leaned across the edge of the boat with the net and scooped beneath the water. When he lifted the fish, he said, ooh-wee, boy, you done caught a damn monster. You gotta be 2 pounds or better. I ain't seen a crappie like this in a long time. Had I tried, I believed I could have stepped over the edge of that boat and walked on Lake Atkins. Daddy wrestled the hook from the fish's throat while blood oozed across his calloused black hands. Then he dropped my prize fish into the 5-gallon bucket. He returned to the back of the boat and to his pole. Ain't too many like that in here, son. I've been fishing this lake a long time. I think you about gonna have the prize for the day. I nodded slightly and rebaited. My joy was greater than any I'd ever known. We caught several others that day, but none like my first catch. On the way home, we rode in silence. It was dark. Dad parked the boat in the field behind the house and we unhitched it. He then put the truck in the garage. Walking up the walkway to the back door of the house, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, looks like somebody done earned his seat in the boat. Yep, I said, looks like it. Thank you, thank you.
So thank you so much, Dr. Daniel Black, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. The imagery of this lake is really beautiful. Tree limbs stretched from one side of the lake cove to the other, and leaning up slightly, I saw wild ferns and other bushes covering the bank like plush carpet. Everything was some shade of green, jade, avocado, emerald, olive, and everything was still. So beautiful. You read it much better than I did. So this is Lake Atkins?
Lake Atkins, that's right.
And so where exactly is this?
Atkins is straight up I-40, going towards Russellville, if that helps, if that helps. And there is one exit. If you miss it, you've missed it. And it's really probably equidistant between Conway and Russellville going up I-40.
Okay, and this is in, for our listeners outside of Arkansas, this is somewhat central Arkansas?
That's right, central Arkansas, yes ma'am.
Right in the middle of the state?
Right.
And so, do you have other fishing stories with your dad on this particular lake? Since this was your first time, did y'all go again?
Oh my God, if I had a dollar for every time we've been fishing, I'd be a rich man. But not just me and my father, my brother too. And my brother's actually here with me tonight, so I'm very happy about that. So he knows all these stories. But we fished, we fished probably every weekend if we could, mm-hmm. You know, if there wasn't other work to do. And I just groomed this love for feeling the weight on the end of that other line. You know, it's a rush like I cannot begin to tell you. People who fish, you know, you get it. The minute it tugs, you just have all this adrenaline, you know. And in some ways, I think the thing I enjoyed most is that we would fish and we'd go home and we'd clean it and we'd cook it and we'd eat. Mm. And that in and of itself isn't the big deal, but the big deal became that we didn't have to go to a grocery store. Mm-hmm. You know, that nature itself had provided the meals. And because we lived on a farm, you know, we had peas and cabbage and corn and all that. And we could make an entire meal and never go to Kroger. You know. And now I live in Atlanta and I hate going to Kroger.
And so do you still fish now?
Are you still fishermen? I do. I fish religiously. In fact, I drove here from Atlanta. All my fishing gear is in my trunk. Because my prayer was that one day, somewhere for 2 or 3 hours, I was going to get a little break and I was going to find a piece of water somewhere.
At the end of your story, you say, "We caught several others that day, but none like my first catch." So have you ever caught another one like your first catch, either size-wise or metaphorically?
You know, the truth of the matter is that fishermen are the greatest liars in the world, you know. We tell the most amazing stories, and we have the time to, because anyone who fishes know that most of the time you don't catch anything, right? And you're really just sitting there imagining the fish you would have caught. And so, yes, I've certainly caught fish as big as that fish, but I remember it because it was so gargantuan, and I was so little. And, you know, things are bigger when you're smaller, mm-hmm. You know? And most times now when I'm reeling in a fish, I'm just imagining, is this fish like that first one? Is this fish like... And I've caught a few that were even bigger. And when I do, I have an excitement that, you know, I feel like I could just die and go to heaven that day. Nothing else matters. I could just have a whole string of fish, and me and Jesus would just fry them, and we'd have a ball.
And so, speaking of, did you eat your prize fish that night?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I come from pretty poor folks. And if you know, if you understand what that means, that's, you know, you don't mount anything, right? You take a picture of it if you want a memory, you know. We're going to eat this, you know. This, you know, catch and release. Who came up with that? You know, whatever we caught, we took home. So, absolutely, you know, and of course, I was like, oh, wow, it's great. You know, look at it real good. Get you a good look, because in a minute, it's going to be in the frying pan. Yeah.
And so on your farm, you had crops as well. So y'all were able to have garden and...
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, we had, again, peas and corn and okra and tomatoes. I've shelled so many purple hull peas that to this day, I don't have to have one ever. not ever. But, you know, we grew up that way. And now I have an amazing appreciation for it. But also I realize now it was an amazing amount of work. Mm-hmm. And I just don't want to work that hard anymore. You know, not if I can help it. Only then to become a writer and end up working harder.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, it was great.
Good. All right, well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
Daniel, would you tell us about your other books, please? Which has been your favorite?
Well, choosing a favorite book is like choosing a favorite child, you know? You always get in trouble. But certainly the biggest selling book of mine so far has been Perfect Peace. And Perfect Peace is the story of this very desperate mother who has 6 sons, and she wants a daughter just so badly she can practically taste it in her mouth. But she gets pregnant for the 7th time, and lo and behold, this is a boy also. But she decides to raise her 7th son as the daughter she's always wanted. And she pulls it off. She pulls it off. How she pulls it off is even miraculous to me. But, you know, she really, really pulls this off. And I think readers have found that story probably most intriguing. I also think that I've really grown as a writer. So I think the quality of the writing has improved up to Perfect Peace. And so I think it has, I think it's benefited me on so many, many, many levels. And I also think that it has engendered discussions about issues of gender construction that have, in many cases, just kind of been swept under the rug, especially here in the South. So I'm proud to say that it has sparked the kind of discussion that I hoped it would.
I find it fascinating that people, or children of Arkansas, sons and daughters, have become so successful outside our own state. Mm-hmm. And I congratulate you on
Thank
that.
You.
That's marvelous,
Thank
and you've
you.
Got a great resume.
Thank
what
you.
I'm wondering is there any position at any university or other school of higher learning in the state of Arkansas that might be able to tempt you back?
Wow. You know, dollar signs speak. So the answer to that is absolutely. You know, just tell them to get the dollars talking and we'll get going, you know. No, I think that's true. In fact, I was talking to Lincola Sullivan, if some of you remember her, dear friend of mine. We're from the same hometown not long ago. And it is true. Very often, leaving this state happens. But I think some of that is because also, especially if you're really artsy and really edgy, I want to say this very beautifully. Arkansas can invite you to go elsewhere for a season, you know. And then once you get some level of notoriety, you get a welcome home. You know, did I say that nicely? Okay. So that's often what happens, I think. And I also think what's tricky is getting people to really invest in education, in arts, and not just in school, but in education. Really teaching people to understand points of view and to honor different points of view, and not to believe that another point of view means that this person is somehow problematic, is somehow your enemy. But to learn to coexist with difference is a trait that I think we could use a little more practice with.
First of all, thank you so much for being here. It's incredible enjoyment out of this.
Wow, thank you.
Was there one story that you maybe as a youth said, this is what I'm going to do?
Yes. I always wanted to write. I always loved storytelling. I always loved literature. When I was a kid growing up, my great-grandmother lived next door to us in this little four-room house that's actually still standing. And after school, I would go to her house and I would read to her. Her eyesight became bad in her latter years, and I would read to her. And sometimes for hours, she loved reading. She loved stories. She had been a school teacher. And I would read to her. And when I became maybe 12, 13 or so, I was reading to her from the Reader's Digest. And she began to chastise me for the way I was reading it. I'd read some out loud and she'd say something like, that's not how that character said it. You know, say it the way they said it. You know, she's sitting there rocking with her eyes closed, you know. And so I would have to change these voices and change voice inflections. And, you know, if it said she shouted, I'd have to read that before I, you know, got to whatever she said so I could shout it out. If not, I was going to get in trouble, you know. But what it really bred in me a love for language. And so I've always had a love for language. And one of the things I think is magnificent about Arkansas is the incredible wealth of language variety and language difference. We've just not yet learned to understand this as part of our inheritance and part of our heritage as a people in the state. And instead of thinking that there's some flawed and faulty about the tongue, it's really another manifestation of a kind of spiritual divinity. And so what I've been trying to do is trying to capture this on the page, which is extraordinarily difficult. You know, speaking slang and dialect is one thing, writing it is a whole nother beast. And so I've really worked hard to really incorporate that, because as a kid, I remember growing up in the country and I loved the way people talked and I loved people's laughter. I come from a very kind of boisterous, cacophonous people. And so on Friday nights, on Saturday nights, when my father and his friends would hang around out in the garage, they would talk loud and laugh loud and, you know, and the laughter would be like, ha, 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 you know. And I loved that. I used to sit around and just laugh at them laughing, you know. Trying to figure out how to make them laugh like that on a sheet of paper is a very difficult thing. But it's something I'm trying to do because I believe it's an inheritance that's musical. I think it's really, really musical to our ears. So, yeah.
You've been speaking of inheritances.
Yes, ma'am.
I read somewhere that your grandmother was grooming you to be a transformer.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you speak about that and then tell me where I can go to do that too?
You'd have to go in the spirit realm to get her now, you know? But what I meant by that is, as a kid growing up, again, I tell you the story about us reading together. People made me feel, and sometimes told me that I was a strange kid. Now I don't see that. I had no comprehension of that. You know, maybe my brother would confirm that. But you know, I felt very regular to myself. You know, But as a kid growing up, my grandmother would, she'd tell me things like, I'd say, Grandma, people think I'm strange. She'd say, child, God is strange. And then she'd just leave it. Like, you know, I hope you get it, you know. And, or, you know, there were times when I'd say, you know, I've had a hard day. And I remember one thing she said. She said, if you will continue being who you are, the world will follow you one day. But you'll have to let them catch up to you. Right. And it just looks like that day might be coming.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel Black, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience here at William F. Lehman Public Library in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Thank you to Trio's Restaurant for the fantastic dinner. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. are you just playing games with my heart?
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.